Yo, what is up, guys? Welcome back to Tag Team, the Pokemon Trading Card Games premier podcasting duo, live in the final week before the World Championship. Now, reminder that JW and I are both going to be in Japan for 2 weeks preceding and after the World Championship, so we will not be recording the podcast during this week. We might try and do some fun stuff while we're there together, but don't expect kind of like regular podcast uploads over the course of that period of time. So this will be the last episode before Worlds.
Expect would be August 23rd. Yeah, I would say.
Yep. So this is the last episode before Worlds, and then we'll kind of do all of our post Worlds and season celebration sort of annual episode that we like to do around that time, the week of August 21st. 21st. So, but yeah, it's so exciting. You know, just a few short days separate us from Japan.
I know, three sleeps.
It's crazy. I'm not gonna lie, I've been a little stressed out about this whole experience. Not for like any outwardly negative reasons. I was trying to explain this to my friend today. Like, I feel like with everything going on, I feel good in my life. Like, I feel happy. Mm-hmm. I am enjoying what's going on. But I am got a little bit of that stress just like pre-travel, like, oh, what am I gonna forget? I had a dream last night that I like submitted the wrong deck list, and as I tried to fix it, like, I didn't have any of my cards with me, you know, like,
I think that's my biggest thing is the cards, because when we were in London, you know, I could have procured any card in English, yeah. But the fact that we're in a non-English speaking country for Worlds just means that I've done a better job than I think I've ever done in my life.
Curating your cards.
Yeah, just making sure that I have, you know, okay, I have every single card for the top three decks that I'm going to play. And then I also have, you know, a handful of cards for other decks that we want to at least test.
Yeah.
You know, while we're there. And just like, you know, again, kind of, I have about stuff for like five or six archetypes. And that's like way different than I've ever had. Like a one archetype or two deck Marty over here, but
and you're always borrowing like the two cards.
I do still have like a few of those cards, but I'm trying really hard to get them before I go.
You're
over,
always so. Borrowing the two cards and they never make their way back into my trove.
Hey, well, just tell me what they are.
No,
tell me
it's
what
fine.
They are, and they'll go no, right back.
And you had like one of my Leons for like 6 months or something.
I think I gave that back.
You did. That's why I mentioned that one. It's all good. It's all good. But yeah, so obviously we're super excited for Worlds. That said, if you do happen to forget a card and you can't find it in English, an alternative could be to completely rebuild your deck in Japanese. Did you consider that?
You know, I actually have, because I was thinking about, well, how much would it cost to buy a full deck in Japanese? And I don't think it'd be that much.
Yeah.
Like, I know their cards are a little more plentiful.
I guess it depends on the deck, right? Because some, like Mew, yeah, for example, you know, true. The Cramomatics are infamously expensive in Japan compared to the United States.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So yeah, hopefully I don't forget a card. I'm going to tonight try to just like flesh out like a couple and then
I did my inventory today.
Yep, put them in my bag.
Yep.
So that
yep,
I just
here.
Like at the very least I have, you know, my top two decks, they're fully sleeved, they're, you know, ready to go, have every card that I need. So
yeah, I'm with you, man. Tonight. And I've been trying to just get all my ducks in a row. Like, I got my eSIM figured out for my phone today.
You put me on the eSIM.
I know, you didn't know about the eSIM grind. I got my rail pass sorted out as well. So, you know, trying to just get all those, like, those little bits and pieces that kind of, like, itch away at you, you know, and get them all sorted out. But I'm super excited. This is going to be a really fun trip, I think, from start to finish, right? The World Championship sort of first week of the trip is going to be amazing. But I'm also just so excited to be in Japan for that second week, you know, have access to that rail pass, go wherever we want, like, do cool things. I'm just really pumped. I know you feel the same as well.
Yeah, it's gonna be awesome.
So for this week's episode, you know, we kind of waffled a little bit on exactly what we want to hit on, but where we landed is this format's been talked about a lot at this point, including by us. So we're not planning on spending a whole episode talking about the Worlds format. If you're looking for some of our thoughts in more detail, you can go ahead and listen to any of like the last five or so episodes where we talk about this format. So instead, we're going to spend the first half talking a little bit about next season. We got a lot of details about what's coming up for next season. So we'll dive into that. And then in the latter half, we'll talk about that final push for Worlds, so to speak. Like, what are some of the big things on our radar? You know, what are things that maybe we don't care, you know, we're not factoring into our deck decision. And that'll be sort of our pre-Worlds roundup there. So with that, I think let's just jump right into it, JW. We got the next season. It really is around the corner, right? With the World Championships, you know, 10 days away now. So next season is right in front of us. And we got a lot of detail now. So just a recap of the sum aggregate of what we've seen, we have a regional schedule now for most regions. You know, if you're in Australia, for example, they have not announced your regional championships yet. We have the point structure. We have best finish limits for all the different tiers of events. We have the point payouts for every tier of event, which is different compared to previous seasons. Yeah. So there's a lot going on, and there's been a lot of discourse over the last few days about sort of what that looks like. I think, you know, first and foremost, the thing that's really grabbed people's attention is the invite threshold, which is, yes, I think it's the highest it's maybe ever been.
We were just talking about this before the cast. I mean, I can't remember. I remember when it first went to 500 and how big of a deal that was.
That was like right when I started playing.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, and we're going to talk more about this, but it's at 600 now, of course, for North American Masters. And there's less opportunity to get points from locals. So this is like kind of a two, you know, a punch in the jaw and a jab to the gut for especially North American players, that you're much more restricted by how many points you can get at locals. You have a best finish limit of 6 for both the cups and challenges, and you have a higher threshold overall for a day one invite. So it's really going to be, again, I'm looking at this through the perspective of North American players, but it's really going to be a grind next year, and only the best players, I think, are going to be able to, you know, ultimately attain that Worlds invite.
Yeah, and this whole, you know, situation is really revitalized a discussion I think we see periodically in the Pokemon community, right, about what is a fair threshold for Worlds. What is Worlds actually supposed to represent is another consideration. And I think that's an interesting debate. Consistently, I've fallen on the side of, if Worlds is the only reason you're playing, like all you're trying to do is chip away at like these top 256 finishes and get a Worlds invite, like I almost question the value in that, so to speak. Like, are you really like, are you playing to improve? Are you like having fun at these events? If that's your only goal, you know, are you getting the best? Do you deserve to be in the World Championship as a competitor? if your goal is to top 56?
No, I mean, really, that's a very fair thing to ask. And what I think a lot of players don't maybe need to hear is that you don't decide if you're a Worlds qualifier. Like, you don't decide if you're worthy of a Worlds invitation. Your performance within the confines of the system determine if you're worthy of a Worlds qualification. And I've seen a lot of discourse on Twitter where people are like, oh, you know, it's way too high. Like, I got it this year. Like, I know I'm a Worlds caliber player. And it's like, well, that was this year, or that was last year, or that was 10 years ago, or whatever it was. But this upcoming year is much more constrained. You're going to have to play much better over a longer period of time.
Yeah.
So, and the thing I really just dislike that.
And you know, like, it's not completely out of reach either at 600, but you have to put in the work for it, right? You know, you have to be clipping away at those local finishes. You have to have actually like a pretty substantial regionals finish, especially if you're not actually capping out at the X6 regional limit. And ideally, like, you're probably also needing to finish at one or two internationals. And
yeah, I think
that's tough, right? That's tough.
I mean, of course, and this was the same for this last year, especially for players in the, you know, chase for top 16 or top 22 or whatever your region's, you know, top X was. But the internationals are going to hold still in this next season, like, an enormous amount of weight, for better or for worse. But yeah, they just, you know, it's much simpler to get these points at internationals than it is to get them at a regional, or
definitely
at, you know, so yeah, I think
that's like especially worth calling out. Yeah. Like, if you're someone who's flying to a lot of regionals, I would really consider replacing one of those with at least UIC. If you're in the United States, like, that tends to be the most accessible. And just the value of the points at these internationals relative to both your placement and the monetary investment is so incredibly high. Mm-hmm. I think it's by design, clearly, on Pokemon's part. But, you know, I would almost rather fly to one IC than go to two regionals.
That's a really strong point that you bring up. Because, I mean, in this at NAIC last year, or I guess this season, last season, if we're looking at the new season, but this most recent NAIC, I did probably the best I'd ever done at NAIC at this Nats tournament. I went 5-4 and I got 60 points. It was like, it's absurd. Like, it's like, it's like, you know, the United States government printing money. The points are free at international championships. And that was even me, like, conceding my last round, like, just because I wanted to give the high schooler I was playing against, like, a good taste in their mouth, you know? And so it's just, you gotta, the internationals are so crazy. If you really are on that grind, like, make those commitments to go to those ICs if you can. Now, there is a big, I really would hate to see people pour all this money and time and effort into an endeavor that, you know, and I guess it's worth it, you know, different amounts for different people, but I'd hate to see people pour all this time, money, and effort into achieving a world's invite at the expense of their mental health, at the expense of their bank account. Because again, this will be a much more difficult worlds to get into than we've seen. I mean, really, since I've been playing the game, like, I just look at it and it just seems like, unless you win the regional and you get an auto qualification, like, it's just going to be much more of a grind, especially with how many players are trying to play in these events. I only see that getting bigger with that auto qualification carrot on the end of the stick for every regional. Like, I only see more players trying to play later in the season. It's just going to be much more difficult. So
I would say I'm a huge fan of the auto qualification. I've been asking for this for years.
Love. That is a really nice touch. I think that's beautiful. And we'll talk about that in a second. But I just, to frame it, if you're thinking like, well, you know, this was the year I finally like saved up enough money to go out to all my events and stuff. It's like, I personally would say, if you can't see yourself like top eighting or winning a regional, like, do not do it. I mean, and that's not me saying like, oh, don't pursue your dream. I'm just saying, be realistic with your expectations, because if you're going into these regionals and you're like, well, I hope I get top 256, like we were talking about earlier, like, that's just a horrible mindset. That's a horrible mindset.
And I guess, like, don't do it with the intention of like world's qualification being the whole reason that you're doing it, right? Like, if you're doing this with the intention of like hanging out with your friends and traveling, like, all power to you, right? Like, enjoy the hobby.
No, 100%. I'm not trying to gatekeep it. I'm just saying, like, again, this is, I'm looking at the points and I'm looking at the structure and I'm looking at the system that they put in place, and I'm seeing players who, you know, will have horrible mental health trying to chase this dream. I will see players that will put themselves into financial ruin trying to chase this dream, and I just want to give that kind of that, you know, fatherly advice and just say, you know, be realistic with what your expectations are, be realistic with what you have done so far in the game. And again, not to gatekeep, but just to say, is this really something that is worth risking time, money, effort for? Yeah. And if it is, again, like, super happy for you. I don't think any less of you if, you know, you go to every single regional and you don't get the invite. Like, I'm not going to think like, oh, they wasted their money. I'm just trying to say, be realistic, because I think this last year put a lot of players into a bit of a lull. I would say that this was, frankly, the easiest year that I can remember to qualify.
Yeah, with the reduced Worlds. Invite and, plus locals coming back was
pretty nuts. Yeah, and so I think we might be, and this goes back to the general kind of community thought surrounding Worlds being this, like, the only thing that you go to an event to, you know, achieve points towards. Like, there's no other reason you would ever go if not to get to Worlds. But it was, from my view, one of the easier, if not the easiest, years to make a Worlds invite. And again, not taking away from anyone that did it, I'm just saying I've been playing for over 10 years and this is what I notice. And so it's kind of lulled, I think, some people into thinking that it will be a similar thing in the future. And this year they had, you know, largely middling finishes and they were able to make their Worlds invite again. And that's also coming, like, from me too. Like, I did not have the greatest season of, you know, this was probably among my worst seasons in terms of higher placements, but I was still able to walk away with the Worlds invite. Like, everything was good. That's going to change dramatically next year, at least again, from what I'm looking at on paper.
Yeah. I'm with you, man. And I think, yeah, just setting those fair expectations for yourself. And I really would, I'd like to take a full episode sometime early next season and really talk about, you know, appropriately balancing your life in the game and how you can do that effectively. Because I think some folks might need to hear that in the wake of this structure change. But yeah, so the point threshold's going way up. GW and I are still going to try our hardest to get an invite. But you know, it's going to be a tough year. I would say this is probably the toughest year when championship points have been the metric. You know, you might argue that some of, like, the ELO based or, like, top 40 NA based ones were harder. But that's, like, a completely different system at that point. So
yeah, right.
Cool. Well, there's other, like, big changes that are coming too, to be fair. So yeah. I think first and foremost, and this is kind of, like, almost inverse to the points going up, is there are now additional kickers to every tier of event. Most notably, there is a 5-12 kicker, so a top 5-12 kicker at regionals and internationals. It's been reduced from 1,500 players to 1,024 players. The points are pretty middling at that point, I'm not going to lie, which I guess they should be, at least at the regional level. You know, at the regional level, if you're getting top 5-12, you're getting 20 points, right? That's a league challenge, basically. Right. So, you know, if you're working in the mindset of those be like pity points, like, yeah, they're kind of pity points, but it's something, right? It's something for your work. And I think it encourages people to, like, play out instead of just dropping, which I guess I'm a fan of personally. You know, I was talking to some friends over the last week about some of my own, like, unhealthy attitudes about the game and how I get really frustrated when I'm not winning out all the time. So I like the idea of, like, encouraging people to continue to participate in the event, even after they get, like, a second loss. I don't think these will make a huge difference at the end of the day. I think it feels a lot better though, that you have a larger percentage of the tournament getting points than you did this season. I don't know. Do you think this is, like, groundbreaking at all?
Not at all. It should not matter whatsoever. Because again, you're looking at a best finish limit of 6 for regionals. And so, you know, if you're like, I just don't see it ever really making a difference, because you can map out your route, right? Like,
yeah,
if you max out, the only way I could see this making any difference is, like, if you max out your performances at locals, you can get a maximum point total of 390.
Uh-huh.
And that's still 210 points away. That's, like, I mean, that's significant. I mean, that is a lot. That's a lot. I'm like saying it out loud. Like, that is a lot of ground that you have to make up over a regional season. You know, that's four finishes in, you know, somewhere in that top 64, top 128. That's, you know, a top four and, you know, a top 16, right? Like, there are some really solid performances that you have to have at regional. So I don't see this making the difference. I see it, like you said, encouraging players to, you know, stay in the tournament longer. I see it doing things for just that new player,
yeah,
that wants to see their name on the leaderboard.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and just being that, like, oh, hey, you know, I got points, you know, like, that's kind of cool. Like, I earned some partial, you know, step towards the world championship qualifier, whatever. But I don't see it really, frankly, making that much of a difference. We've talked a lot about in the past just how poorly, at least I think, the regionals point total is poorly structured.
Yeah.
You know, being in the top 10% of the tournament, or even the top 5% of the tournament, like, should not award you as many points as winning a League Cup, in my opinion.
I'm with you, man. I'm with
so
you.
I think the whole system is kind of fricked a little bit. It's just a little wonky. Like, they need to basically, like, add 30 points, in my opinion, to every single, you know, to every single tier. But I digress. It's cool to come down again for the reasons I stated. Like, it'll make somebody, if it makes somebody feel a little bit better, you know, again, I don't think the 20 points at top 512 is going to do anything for anyone in the chase. But if it makes one new player, or even one old player, like, hey, you know, I walked away with something, and it keeps players in the tournament longer, mm-hmm. like, that's a net positive for very, you know, little investment on the company's part.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, you know, it's not going to be the highest impact change, but it's something. I do think it makes more of an impact at the ICs. You know, at NAIC, I think we're likely to continue to cross the previous 512 threshold, but at UIC, mm-hmm. for example, you might not hit that, like, 1500 player mark, but you could hit the 1024 player mark for sure. So that's 60 points, I believe, at an IC. So that actually does kind of make a difference.
Points. Yeah, 50 points.
50, sure. But still, that makes a difference as opposed to the regional situation there. And like JW said, we also got our BFLs announced. So you got the six local, basically six of every event besides the ICs, because there's only four of them. So just that's your rule of thumb, is you can finish six times at any given tier of event. So six challenges, six cups, six regionals. That's your slate there, and then as many ICs as you can fit. You know, historically, we've seen like eight, I think, be a common threshold, particularly around cups. We've had eight, you know, two a quarter is kind of been the rule of thumb for cups, so it's a little bit less for cups. And, you know, overall, that also serves to inflate the point threshold, right? Particularly around locals. You know, regionals, not that many people are actually capping out their finishes outside of, like, top 16 chasing. But locals is really what kind of defines those caps. And that's 100 points of League Cups that are no longer available if it were 8 versus 6. So that serves to make the invite, like, that much higher, I would say, is really the impact of the BFL.
Absolutely. I think one of the other things that I want to touch on just a little bit, again, coming from a North American perspective before we move off the, like, total points topic, is that it does feel slightly, with the inflated point total for North America, 600 for Masters, it does feel slightly kind of a little more time consuming. I mean, obviously, right? Like, it's going to be more time consuming. You're going to have to spend, you know, probably likely for the average player, multiple more weekends going to tournaments and doing locals and everything to get those finishes. So I'm a little just disappointed at that. Like, to travel to every regional, and not that I'm going to, but to travel to every regional in America versus traveling to every regional in Europe, is very different, just in terms of the amount of time and the cost and the ease of travel. So I'm slightly disappointed by the kind of time expectation. Like if you just kind of map out like your, you know, again, as an average player, where, you know, you would expect to get your points at.
Yeah.
Just a reasonable point total. So I'm a little disappointed with that. I felt like, you know, maybe in the future they could lower the point totals, but also lower maybe the, you know, best finish limits or something like that to make it so that you had to, you know, you maybe didn't have to travel as much for achieving a World's End. That said, like we were talking about early, like this will be in the next season one of the most refined, I think, set of Worlds participants.
And
because this is really like last year, again, fairly easy comparatively. This year, I think it's going to be much more difficult, and we should see the best of the best play at the World Championships, which overall, a good thing.
Yeah, I actually want to dive a little bit more into that. Like, this will be an elite World Championship this next year. Because one thing I think is a really positive change on the whole is the restructure of the top 16, top 22, I don't even know what to call it, like the travel awards type thing. So in years past, including this season in Yokohama, the top 16, top six, top 22, whatever, top four, depending on your region, qualified automatically for day two of the World Championship. And so day one and day two are just completely separate events for all intents and purposes. Day one is basically a last chance qualifier. I'm pretty sure since they've done that system, a day two player has won every single World Championship. And I don't think that's necessarily because they're that much better than day
one. No, Jason Klasinski did go through day one.
Okay, except for maybe Jason.
I think if that wasn't an LCQ, I mean, I think that was day one, day two.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be interested, I guess, on the facts on that. But the frequency at which day two players
and it's like, on the one hand, it's like, okay, it's obvious because the best players that are traveling are getting the most points. But on the other hand, you know, like you said, it's kind of, if I could basically, if you take a tournament, any tournament, a regional tournament, and you give me a 5-0 record, like, yeah, I'm probably going to.
Right. And that's where I'm going with that. Right. The day two players, sure. The best players in the world are those players who qualified for day two. But are they at like such a higher caliber than every other player in the world that no one else is winning the World Championship? To me, right. The answer is no. But they get the substantial benefit of they start in the real tournament. So going forward, instead of a day one, day two, like separate tournament structure, there is one World Championship tournament, and those top players, they can get a bye, a one round bye. Or they can get just the travel stipend as the tier two, which is a new concept, is the tier two invite. So instead of getting a bye, you still get a travel award, but you don't get anything extra. You just get a paid trip, which I think is cool. I love that idea. That's something I've also wanted Pokemon to do for a while, is have like a middle tier between like getting the in-tournament advantage and getting nothing besides just going to Worlds. So I think it's a great idea as well. I think it also just generally evens out the playing field while still acknowledging the players who did the best, the most consistently over the season. And a one-round bye, that's still a huge deal, right, at this tournament. But it's not such an overwhelming advantage that it just, like, completely, like, invalidates almost the day one field.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. You know, and it's interesting, too, because then it also... one of the critiques of the two-day system is that you're allowed to change your deck heading into day two. So that is a massive advantage where the day two players can sit back. They can say, this new rogue deck popped up. Like, I can actually figure out how to play against it before I might actually see it in day two. Or the general field had a lot of this deck. So with that in mind, I'm going to tech my deck against what did well in day one.
Yeah, I mean, the whole day two system, the cards were stacked in favor of the day two players.
Yes.
Absolutely. They also get the lack of mental fatigue, right? Like,
Yeah. I mean, it, and it, we're not like, we're not hating. I mean, this is not, we're not hating. It's just,
it no, was a it's system the system.
With flaws. It was a system with flaws. A system that certainly benefited the rich. And you know, the rich, just not, you know, not necessarily financially, but just, you know, the day two players.
It's a rich get richer type of thing. Like if you're already richer, exactly. If you're already sort of one of those top players, then you get this astronomical advantage as added on top of that. So of course they're winning like every world championship.
Except this year.
Except this year for when JW and I get first and second place. and Andrew gets like fifth.
Yeah. Oh no, no, he'll get ninth again.
Okay. Yeah. Andrew gets ninth. And we get first and second.
That'd be so sick, dude.
And he gets ninth, like he gets a Cal Connor ninth too, where he like makes it and then gets bumped out.
Oh, sad.
That would be heartbreaking.
That would be heartbreaking.
And he gets that Cal Connor ninth as the eighth seed. Yeah, that's the extra.
Oh, that'd be heartbreaking. That'd be
so I would lose it to be on
both sides of that coin for him.
Yeah, I would lose my mind if I was the eighth seed and lost like the 8-9 match and didn't get top 8 at world. Especially if it was my second 9th place at world. Well, regardless, I think it's gonna be a really interesting season ahead. I'm really curious for where the world championship's gonna be. I think that's gonna help inform like my own approach to the season as well. GW, are there any, like, you know, we have the regional schedule, are there any like for sures or pretty probable ones for you on that list?
I mean, it's tough. I don't really know too much. Like, I'm only looking, you know, 6 inches in front of my face at this point, but you know, Pittsburgh seems to be a go at this point. And then I think really realistically, any tournament in driving distance is probably a go. I mean, we have the benefit of, or I have the benefit of living in Ohio, which is a largely centralized area to be in to hit all these tournaments. So
yeah, no joke.
Pittsburgh, man. Peoria, Toronto is always great because I could potentially like pick up my brother on the way, and stay with him right on the border. Charlotte, Knoxville. Orlando always has cheap flights. Indy. I mean, these are not set in stone at this point, because again, when you have a kid, there's a little more logistics.
Yeah, things change.
But you know, these are the ones that I immediately look at and say, you know, might be doable.
Yeah, actually, Peoria is on as far as the list that's available right now, which I think will grow at least a couple tournaments. You know, it's a little odd to me that the current slate ends in May and not June. And there's no Wisconsin regional, which also kind of sticks out. But the current list, Peoria is the closest to me by like a lot. And that's actually the one that I can't go to. I for sure can't go to. So I have a project that's going live in San Diego, and then I have a work trip in San Diego the next week, so I'm just staying there through those two trips. So I'm there like during the weekend of Peoria, but as a consequence, I might be able to tack on Sacramento on the tail end of that trip. So I am going to Pittsburgh. I decided the other day. I got that all booked and everything already. So I'll be at Pittsburgh at the least, if nothing else. And we'll kind of play it out from here. I'm planning to be on Charlotte. And the rest, I put a bunch of like shrug emojis next to on my notes app because I don't know yet. I'll plan to go to Indy probably as well. That's like my upper threshold of what's drivable.
Well, I'm definitely trying to invite and chill. So catch me at Pittsburgh winning the tournament.
The ultimate way to invite and chill is to just win Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh just, in particular,
not play a single event for the rest of the season.
That would be so insanely sick. I think that's the least effort someone could put in besides getting top four at Worlds the year prior. Like the least amount of Pokemon you can play and still go to the World Championship.
Yeah, what it would be? It'd be 19 rounds.
Yeah,
or 18 rounds.
18, yeah, 18.
You could theoretically play 18 games. A Pokemon get a world's invite. Think about that. Even less, I guess, if you ID'd. You could theoretically play, what, 16? 15 games.
Yeah, 15.
You just got to go on a 15-0 win streak. I mean, that's doable, man.
It is. So that could happen. It's like not outside the realm of possibility. That's the crazy thing.
I'm just curious, like, the probability of that. And if somebody could calculate that for us.
The exact probability of that specific thing happening, yeah.
Yeah, like, how, you know, you could see, like, the model would be like, okay, how many players have gone 9-0 in day one versus how many competitors have there been, you know, multiplied by the amount of tournaments. And then you'd have, you know, how many players have gone, what, like 4-0-2 in day two. And then again, same multiplication. And then how many have played, like, how many games are often decided with one single game? How many rounds are decided with one single game? Or, like, yeah, one.
I don't think those things are, like, draw. Like, those aren't unrelated, though, right? You can't just assume those things are all completely unrelated to each other and multiply the probability. Like, I have to imagine, like, if your deck is the kind of deck that only ever wins a one-game set, then the odds of you going 9-0 are different than other decks.
Imagine you were the type of player that only won series 1-0.
Interesting. But the thing is, if you're only playing one game, the key is the game has to go the full 50 minutes, right? Because
yeah, and you have to win in time, right?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm thinking more completed game. So, you know, you could complete a game and then start a second one.
Sure.
You know?
But
because again, it's only
that second win. That second game's got to be in its infancy, though.
Yeah, it's got to win 15 games.
Yeah, that's right? Fair.
Win 15 games. We so if the other one first. Doesn't complete, then.
Yeah. All right. I'm with you now. Yeah. Because the playing 15 games, I was like, oh man, like, this is getting really in there. Especially in top 8, where you get the 70-minute
run. Yeah. Man, you'd have to, like,
imagine watching that stream game.
You'd have to count their deck
probably four times before you draw your card for turn.
Probably, man.
Probably at least that many times.
Every turn.
Probably every turn. Yeah. So I'm really excited, though. You know, I'm amped up for next season. Let's go ahead and transition over to card of the day, and then we'll wrap up by just chatting really quickly about Worlds.
Let's do it.
So, GW, for today's card of the day, I forget if we've done this one before, but I really was inspired to do it. So this is an item card. It's an iconic item, and it is...
Toxic Laser. Boom. Got it.
No, that is like a very iconic item, though. It's not as iconic to me because it wasn't standard legal. When I played, it had just rotated at that point.
Dodged a bullet.
It's an item card that accelerates energy.
Oh, okay. Dark Patch.
No, not from the discard.
Iconic. Oh, Mega Turbo.
I was thinking Max Elixir, but...
Max Elixir,
you know. And part of the reason I was thinking of Max Elixir is I was going through the exercise that you were saying of trying to find every card you could possibly want and make sure they're crammed into your box. And I realized I found this, like, clear sleeve that was just in the middle of freaking nowhere in my apartment. And it had my electric generators in it.
Nice.
And that reminded me of Max Elixir because... Electric generator is just Max Elixir on. It's better in some ways and worse in others. Like, it doesn't see the sixth card, but it also can accelerate too. But it's sick. Yeah. But Max Elixir, man, that card was so sick. I remember building my longtime listeners and fans of Card of the Day will know that my first ever deck was Darkrai Hypno. And Max Elixir was so broken in that deck. And it was so broken, in fact, that I, independently of the metagame, realized that Turbo Dark was the way to play. Because why bother using Max Elixir and then attaching a double colorless when I could just use a bunch of Max Elixirs and then use Dark Pulse?
Obviously.
So fun stuff. Max Elixir's broken. Electric Generator's broken. Fighting Pickaxe. Maybe not.
A little, yeah, mid on.
Yeah, I think there's like a threshold of cards seen that you need to cross for it to really be broken, and Gutsy Pickaxe doesn't really hit it. Same as Aether. Yeah. Aether doesn't really hit it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that's my card of the day. Man. Iconic.
I love.
Insanely powerful item. Max Elixir.
That's like one of, like, if I really had to sit down and think of like top like 250 like dopamine hits of my life, it's, I mean, one of those like has to be hitting a Max Elixir.
Feels so good, like, every time.
Yeah, exactly.
But it also felt so bad when you miss.
Yeah, we're talking about the positives, though. Let's not talk about the negatives.
For sure. So, before we talk about Worlds, then, let's go ahead and quickly thank our sponsor for this week's episode, and then we'll wrap it up.
Sounds good.
So, as you may be aware, the presenting sponsor for the Tag Team Podcast is Manscaped. And let me tell you all, and listeners of the cast, you should already know where I'm going with this. At the World Championship, you already know that I'm going to be wearing my Manscaped Boxers 2.0. Those things are powerful, they're comfy, and they're oh so nice on my down there parts. So Manscaped is the premier men's grooming care brand. Got the boxers, you got the shavers and the grooming kits, and you got the ear, nose, hair trimmers, all the balms and creams, pretty much everything you could want. And let me tell you, at a Pokemon tournament, one of the things I value the most is my appearance and hygiene. Like, I want to be looking clean, smelling good, and I hope you all feel the same. And a great way to do that and level up your game is by checking out Manscaped.
Absolutely. Manscaped has been an awesome brand to partner with because their products are just so good. I use them practically every day. I got their lip balm here on the desk. I wear their boxers all the time. It was like the first thing that I packed when I was getting ready for Japan. So you can go over and get yourself some fantastic products over at manscaped.com. You can use our code TAGTEAM at checkout. You're going to get yourself 20% off plus free shipping. That's 20% off plus free shipping. Combat inflation with that discount code. Go on over to manscaped.com. Use code TAGTEAM at checkout. Get yourself something nice. Or maybe a friend, something nice. Maybe you got a dad who's got a birthday coming up. Maybe you have a partner who needs, you know, a little more
a little encouragement. Help. Yeah.
But whatever it is, you can get anything that you need over at manscaped.com. Use code TAGTEAM, 20% off plus free shipping.
Thank you so much to Manscaped for the continued support of the cast. And thank you so much to all of you for checking them out. Okay. Yokohama, it is really just around the corner here. Like, we're looking at, you know, 8 days. So, JW, we're hitting that final sprint. You know, we're going to travel over in just a few sleeps. We'll probably bang out some games while we're there, and then it's game time. It's time to make that choice and run it. So, I think right now, kind of where is the landscape falling for you? You called out that you had packed two decks. It would be your normal kind of modus operandi. You said you have two decks that are already pre-sleeved heading into Yokohama in addition to your card trove. Yeah. What are you looking at? What's the deal?
Well, I know we've talked in the past about maybe playing a bit of a faster deck, but the more that I play the format, the more these two decks continue to stand out for me. And they are the two decks that I have sleeved, or I'm planning on putting the final sleeves on tonight, are Gardy and Lost Box Tina.
Yeah.
Now, Gardy is a comfort pick. That is the deck that I've kind of played to locals for the last month. That's a deck that I just feel very comfortable with and am open to exploring the various techs that we could play with the deck. I mean, you have a lot of different ways you go with it to counter a lot of what you would expect to see. So given that it's a comfort play, I played it at NAIC, didn't do great, but also ran into some really tough matchups that I did not respect heading into the tournament, that I will definitely have, you know, a better game plan with my list for. I think that's a deck that, you know, a lot of players will choose. I think it's a great day two pick, maybe not the best day one pick, but if it's a great day two pick, if I think it could win the world championships in day two, you know, it's kind of hard to ignore it for day one. And then the other deck that I have been really enjoying recently is, and we've talked about Giratina so much, but Lost Box Giratina has really elevated itself above the competition just in general. I think it has a lot of comeback potential. You obviously look at a couple Roxanne, maybe a couple Iono. And then if you're able to get going in the early game through your Colruses, through attacking with Giratina, like you get to 10 relatively, I wouldn't say quickly, but very consistently. And right. So smoothly, that's where maybe. What's that?
Or like smoothly, yeah. Like
yeah, smoothly. Right. So whereas maybe a turbo Lost Box build would get, you know, a turn three Sableye, like you're probably getting maybe a turn four, but it's like you're backing it up with this 200 HP behemoth, no weakness. That thing is more than likely taking two attacks. And so I just really like the archetype right now. I think it has it's kind of like Guardi in the sense that you pretty much can beat anything. And I think there's a lot of skill expression. I think there's a lot of comeback potential. So if I don't play a deck that has, you know, a lot of like comeback potential, I'll be very surprised. Like a lot of yeah. Iono, a lot of Ian, or excuse me, a lot of Iono, a lot of Roxanne.
Don't play Ian in your deck at Worlds.
Yeah, a lot of Judge. Like if I don't play a deck that has these cards, like I don't know that it's worth playing. But that is one of the decks along with Guardi that I just feel like has that ability to come back in any game, has that ability to outplay opponents. And I've just yeah. really been liking Giratina right now. And I think Lost Box Giratina is certainly a favorite among a lot of players.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Giratina, we talked about it multiple times over the last few weeks about its rise to prominence over the course of the post-NAIC metagame. And, you know, it's no surprise, in my opinion, that it's emerged as one of the top decks on our radar. You know, the weak point, if anything, of the Lost Box Giratina deck is the like traditional Lost Box matchup. But even then, it doesn't feel like it's completely out of your control. And like it feels like less and less people are playing traditional Lost Box just because Arceus has shown up so much as it feels like every format people have to be reminded that Arceus is a deck. And after NAIC, people were reminded Arceus is a deck. And mm-hmm. that's affected Lost Box's position, which has opened up that door for Giratina. I like Giratina a lot. I, for the same reasons you do, you have that comeback potential, and you also have this crazy good attacker for the late game. And I also, I'll emphasize again, the V-Star power is really good on Giratina, of course. Like taking a knockout automatically is, of course, really good.
Holy crap, are you serious?
But, you know, notably, that's something that the Lost Zone variants of Giratina have that, say, an Arceus variant of Giratina doesn't have, is you have that auto knockout. And that's where I was actually going with that. So I think that's cool. Guardi, of course, not a surprise. Just to catch everyone up, part of the reason we say it's not a phenomenal day one play is because it is a slower paced deck, which has, you know, two consequences. First, in day one, people may play like faster paced decks, which may end up having a good matchup into Guardi. And then second, if you take a tie in day one, it is equivalent to a loss unless you have exactly three ties. So you're not really trying to end up in a situation where you're tying in day one, whereas in day two, like taking a tie is still like a match point, which is still a boost to your record. As opposed to just the active detriment it is in day one.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and I'm kind of with you there. Like, those are my comfort picks, I would say. You know, I've really just vibed with Lost Box over the course of the last few formats, or Lost Zone, like, comfy-oriented decks ever since Scarlet and Violet dropped. And Giratina is something that I really enjoyed heading into NAIC, but we were scared off of the potential Lost Box matchup. And I think the door has opened a little bit more for it, which I find encouraging personally.
Yep, absolutely. I think a lot of players are looking though toward Lost Box Giratina. Like I look at You know, and
that's really the only thing that's dissuading me. A lot of the better
players will be playing Lost Box Giratina or Gardy, but that's really how I feel. Like, I feel like these two decks have kind of separated themselves just because with Giratina, there's enough comeback potential in the Lost Box mirror that, you know, as long as you stick a Roxanne or as long as you stick a good Iono, like, you're able to come back in that matchup. I hate to say relatively easily, but there is certainly a path there for you. So even its bad matchup, and similar to Gardy, like, even Gardy's bad matchup, you can play around. Like, there are plays you can make, there are techs you can add to get around those bad matchups. So I do think the day two metagame, and probably the day one metagame for for most players, like, you're going to be hitting those Giratina decks and you're going to be hitting those Gardy decks, and I think that's just going to be the story of this Worlds.
So let's maybe take that on its head then. Something that we've done over the past few tournaments is talk about what you might not care about. What could you plan around taking a loss to, for example, at the World Championship? JW, I'm curious if you have any initial thoughts for, you know, if you were to play the World Championship tomorrow and you had to lock in a deck, what is something you'd be comfortable taking a loss to? That's in the sort of upper echelons of the meta, right? Not like random, Mikion VMAX deck.
Yeah, sure. I'd be comfortable taking a loss to Mew. I think Mew right now is it's under like sideways assault. Like, people have dropped Drapion for the most part in pretty much any deck.
Yeah.
But you're seeing Path of the Peak being heavily featured in Arceus decks like Arceus Giratina or in Giratina Lost Box. And you're seeing like some players play Spiritomb, you know? And then add into the fact that we are playing in Japan, and I would expect to see like a lot more Japanese players. And again, that cost prohibition to playing the deck. Like, if I saw a Mew deck, whatever. Fine, you know, but you have all these other decks that have routes against it. Gardy certainly has routes against it. Lost Zone Tina certainly has routes against it with or without the Spiritomb. Any deck that plays Path and Judge and Iono has routes against it. So I think that there's certainly, like, you know, I look at that deck as not being something that I particularly am worried about. I also think another deck that, like, surprisingly, I'm not worried about, and I don't, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, Riley, if we're all just making a huge mistake, is the NAIC winning Inteleon Urshifu deck. I was going to
specifically ask about that, actually.
Really? Yeah. It's so funny because I have really not seen that deck perform at all at the online tournaments. And one of its worst matchups is a matchup that I would disrespect, which is Mew. So with that in mind, I mean, maybe it makes the Inteleon Urshifu deck a fantastic call for Worlds, but I just don't know why it hasn't picked up the steam in these online tournaments.
Yeah, you know, I was going through this today, right? I was searching through my cards, and I don't have like Inteleon V's or VMAXs handy right now. It's like, do I need to like figure this out right now? Was the initial thought in my mind. And you're right, like, Mew is the matchup that it struggles with the most. I just pulled up the Limitless stats for online tournaments in Paldea Evolved, and it's atrocious into Mew. Yeah. Really, really bad. Almost impressively so. Which is kind of crazy. But, so the Mew matchup, of course, not good. But I'll say, like, notably, it also has, like, a not super great Arceus Umbreon matchup. Obviously, Cyrus did win in those finals, but just like by the stats, it doesn't have a great Arceus Umbreon matchup. It doesn't have a great Lugia matchup. Actually, a pretty poor single strike Lugia matchup. So I don't know. Like, I feel like there's a deck that you kind of can safely disrespect, and I think so for two reasons. First, I think the deck is going to be just implicitly it's unpopular. It's not a popular deck. Yeah, it never will be. It's kind of an anti-meta deck to start with. So even if it wins a tournament, it's not going to show up in droves at the next tournament. And then secondarily, it has enough bad matchups that I think you can reasonably expect to get away with disrespecting it. So the combination of those two things, like, it might be a deck you opt to play, but I don't think you have to necessarily factor it in to your playmaking.
Sure.
And that's where I landed as I was like sorting my cards this morning is, or this afternoon is, you know, I don't think it's something to worry about too heavily.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It certainly like hasn't. And again, I'm using a lot of online tournaments kind of as a barometer, but you know, they're some of the best ways to get just general data points, right? Mm-hmm. It's like very easy to see that Giratina is elevating itself above the competition when we look at these online tournaments. And you know, again, you have to take every result with a grain of salt, but if you're looking for just data points and you're just looking for, you know, trends in the overall metagame, like these are great things to look at. They're not the only thing you should look at, and you should also take into account your own testing and, mm-hmm. you know, talking with other people and what they've been testing. But that's one of the things that I've just seen is like, where is all this Urshifu and Inteleon? Because the metagame, generally speaking, seems fairly favorable for it. And it just won a major tournament, and it's pretty much non-existent. So just very curious on that one.
Yeah, I don't know. Just the Arceus Umbreon, like, just by stats, the Arceus Umbreon and the single strike Lugia matchups are like comparable to Mew, like, and how bad they are. And I just, it seems like a lot of polarized matchups to take amongst like top tier decks,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I don't know if I'd be comfortable doing that myself. So I can't imagine that many other people are.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting.
You know, I think one thing I'm curious about as well is like a traditional loss box. You know, it feels like Giratina has been the star of the show in these online tournaments. And, you know, the forefront of the metagame. Do you think it's actually worth worrying about, like traditional like turbo loss box decks as you factor in your choice? Or do you think it's almost like inconsequential because like Giratina creates a similar matchup for a lot of decks?
It's turbo loss box would be a deck that I would expect to see one time in 8 rounds. Like I would not be shocked to see it one time, like maybe one to two times. But I think that is a concession that I'm willing to make. Certainly, you know, you look at with the two decks that I've chosen, Gardy doesn't take historically hasn't taken the best matchup into Lost Box decks. And then similarly, you know, a Lost Box deck that just has slower attackers to set up that are more cumbersome, like it's not going to be good into that quote unquote mirror. But that said, I think that's a matchup that I'm willing to concede when making my deck choice. Four Worlds is like, well, you know, it's pretty good across the board, but it has this thorn in its side in turbo loss box. I just don't see a lot of players opting for that variant. And frankly, like if it were me, because I've been playing turbo loss box as well at local tournaments, and it really hasn't felt that great. Like I've always wanted some one hit KO potential from Arceus, or I've always wanted maybe an ability to take multiple prizes in a turn with Kyogre. And I think that those might be a little bit more better suited to the current metagame, which has a lot of high HP Pokemon that you're trying to, you know, have to go through every single turn. I find a lot of times with Turbo Lost Box, just in the, you know, on the ladder or testing just against a wide variety of decks is that it runs out of steam in that late game. If it's going against these, you know, multiple 280 plus HP Pokemon. And that's where I'd get a little bit worried for the Worlds is like, you're running into the Arceus decks. You're running into, you know, a lot of these high HP decks that are just going to grind you down over the course of the game. And I don't think that, you know, largely that's going to be a favorable metagame for a turbo loss box build.
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay, so I think in general, like the decks we're considering are decks that can deal out lots of damage, like KO large HP attackers, and have some sort of disruptive element to them. Like that's kind of the through line of what JW mm-hmm. and I are considering for the World Championship, which makes some amount of sense. Like that's a good combo of traits to have, I would say. Yeah. but as opposed to opting for you know, sneakier strategies or more disruptive like like solely disrupted based strategies. So
I do have one question for you, Riley.
Oh yeah.
And this might be a thinker, so feel free to take your time. But do you see any rogue decks popping up at Worlds? I don't really, but I'm curious what you think, like what card or set of cards or maybe just historically low performing archetype has the chance to perform well at this Worlds in kind of that rogue capacity?
Nothing really. I mean, if I had to pull the lever right away, I would say like nothing really jumps out at me that crazy. Which isn't necessarily like a bad thing. Indicative. We've been in this metagame for a while, right? Like, I just don't think people have a lot of tricks left up their sleeve at this point. And maybe I'm wrong on that, but I don't necessarily think so. Like, I don't know, maybe someone's gets another United Wings finish, but you know, that's not a full surprise anymore. Like, we've seen it.
Right.
I don't think people are really gonna be blowing our minds necessarily with their deck choices. You know, maybe their builds are better and more streamlined and more effective, but I think realistically the metagame is going to be something we expect.
Fair enough.
So that kind of brings us there. You know, we've been talking for a long time about the next season and the conclusion of this one. Like we said before, this is going to be our last episode for a few weeks, as JW and I are both going to Japan for the days surrounding the World Championship on both sides. So just keep your eyes open. Like, we'll be posting on social media kind of what's going on, but expect no episode until the week of the 21st. We are so thankful for all of you for your support over the course of the last season. It's been so gratifying to meet so many of you over the course of the season and get to talk to you about your personal experiences and your seasons and your enjoyment of the cast. And we'll be sure to recap the season at large once we're back. If you're interested to follow along with JW and I as we go to the World Championship and have many adventures in Japan, you feel free to do so on social media. The best place to find us is x.com, I suppose. And you can do that at Smiles with Riles for myself, at Real John Walter for JW, and at Tag Team Pokemon for the podcast itself. We also record live every single week besides this brief hiatus on Wednesdays at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. So if you're interested in doing that, go ahead and over to twitch.tv/Munner. That's my Twitch channel. JW also streams at twitch.tv/FlexDaddyRighteous. And he will occasionally be the master behind the podcast recording as well, particularly if I'm traveling. So be sure to give both of us a follow if you want to catch us live.
Absolutely. So that's going to do it for us tonight, guys. Thank you so, so much for listening to the cast. We can't wait to share our exploits in Japan with you. Hoping for a big tag team finish there at the world's most prestigious tournament. That's going to do it all for us tonight. Thank you for joining us. We'll catch you next time.
Peace.
See ya.